Great. Thank you, everyone. This is the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, meeting of November 20th, 2013. The time is just a little after 12:30. A quorum is present. I'm Scott Dibble, gavel for this commission is in the Senate's hands, so I'm acting chair for a few minutes, and we need to have an election first thing. This is the kind of the key statutory responsibility. We can do anything else we want, of course, but one thing we are required to do is to review the Metropolitan Council operating capital budgets for the coming year, and then we're going to have a discussion, just a quick discussion about Metropolitan Council governance ideas, or how to move forward on advancing some ideas. So with that, the first thing we need to do is elect a chair and a vice chair. So why don't we handle those elections separately from each other? Representative Mason.
Can I make a suggestion? Maybe we might want to introduce ourselves first?
Sure, we can do that. Thanks. Great suggestion. I like it. So I've introduced myself. I'm State Senator Scott Dibble. Why don't we start with the newly arrived senator?
Senator Bev Skelton from Little Canada, Badness Heights, Shoreview, Moundsview, Arden Mills, Dim Lake.
Chuck Wigger, District 43.
Jim Carlson, District 51. And I represent most of Eagan and about a third of Burnsville.
Michael Gordon, I'm the committee administrator for the Senate Transportation and Public Safety Committee.
And Michael's just filling in because commission staff has another commission meeting, so Michael's helping us out today. And I'm from Minneapolis.
Hi, Representative Frank Hornstein, District 61A, and that's parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis.
Mike Freiberg, District 45B, all are parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale.
Mary Liz Holberg, most of Lakeville.
Sandra Mason, 51A, which is most of Eagan, west of 35E, and all of northern Burnsville.
Linda Rudbeck, Lionel Lakes, Circle Pines, a little bit of Blaine, a little bit of Hugo, and Lexington and Centerville.
Representative Peggy Scott, 35B, Andover, northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in Ramsey.
Great. Thanks. So thank you for that suggestion. Why don't we just have a few of our staffers who would like to introduce themselves quickly, who are sitting kind of in these first couple rows over here, because they'll be around these commission meetings a lot as well.
I'm Ted York. I'm Senator DeVos' legislative assistant in the Transportation Committee.
Mary Salisbury. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Carlson.
I'm chair committee administrator for the House Transportation Committee.
Bonnie Berzowski, Senate Counsel.
In the back.
Katie Hatch, of CFL Research, covering transportation and housing.
Jamie Hyland, I'm the administrative assistant for the LCC.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen.
I'm Matt Burris, of House Research, covering transportation.
Andy Lee, House Fiscal.
Doug Dyson, local and metro government House Research.
I'm Joe Marble. I cover research for the House GOP for GovOps, State Government Finance.
Anyone else? Anyone else? All right, great. Thanks. So election time. Just got over this a couple weeks ago, so I didn't know we're roaring into another election season here.
Not doing a ranked choice.
Oh, that's a great idea, Representative.
We'll have the results in a couple days.
Yeah. Maybe by next session we'll...
Great. So we need to entertain a motion for chair. Chair comes from the Senate. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would like to place the nomination as the chair, Senator Jim Carlson from Eagan. I think Senator Carlson has a long history of involvement in the kinds of issues that this commission works with, and I think it's very important to have a suburban voice as well, given the regional nature of these issues. So for that reason, I'm placing his name in nomination, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. Our Senator Carlson's name is in nomination. Any other nominations for chair? Seeing none, I will close nominations. Senator Carlson, did you want to give a speech? before we vote.
Not necessarily a speech, but I would like to thank Representative Hornstein for the confidence. And Mr. Chair, I accept the nomination. Okay.
All right, I'll move to a vote. All in favor of Senator Carlson as chair of the LCMG, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senator Carlson is chair. If you don't mind, Senator Carlson will handle the next election, and then we'll invite you to the seat. So we need to elect a vice chair. Vice chair comes from the House, and I would like to place in nomination Representative Freiberg for all the same reasons that Representative Hornstein cited. Great and able representative from the suburbs, with coming from local government as well, so understands the nature of regional issues.
And Mr. Chair, we've got the South Metro and now North Metro.
All right,
North West Metro.
Great. Any other names to be placed in nomination for vice chair? Seeing none, I'll close nominations. Senator Freiberg, or Representative Freiberg, do you want to give a speech? Nope. Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. All in favor of Representative Freiberg as vice chair, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Mr. Chair.
What? Yeah, I think we have a quorum.
Okay. Well, I'll repeat that we do have a quorum, and this is the Legislative Commission on State Government, Metropolitan Government. And I think, I don't know if we need to have any kind of a description of what we do. It is printed in the legislative website, so you can see who we are, what we're supposed to do, what our mission is, and I think we'll get to that right away. So on the agenda is a review of the Metropolitan Council operating and capital budgets for 2014. And if you do testify, please be sure to identify yourself when you come to the table or when you come to the mic, and if there are any questions also. So with that, I'm going to ask our testifiers to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the regional administrator of the Metropolitan Council. In our form of government, for those of you who are new to us, I am the equivalent of the city manager or city administrator of the Met Council. I'm going to make a few brief remarks to open the budget levy financial discussion today and then turn it over to our division executives to give you the details and our chief financial officer to give you also some financial overview. The council is a local unit of government whose board of directors and governing body is appointed by the governor. We operate three fairly distinctive sets of services, planning and operations and grant making. They're organized among these three groups of services: community development, environmental services, and transportation. You'll see a little bit more about that as we go along. But planning, operations, and grant making represent the three principal activities. But operations constitutes the majority, in fact, the overwhelming majority of our budget, and that's what you're going to hear about today. We operate two big regional operating services or utilities. One is the one we call Environmental Services. It's otherwise known as our wastewater utility. And the second is transit operations, carried out mostly through Metro Transit, but not exclusively. Those two operating entities represent about 90% of our employees, and this graph shows the staff complement this year versus 10 years ago. As you can see, there's been a growth overall of about 1% per year over that 10-year period, due almost entirely to the addition of rail transit. We are already beginning to staff up and be prepared for the opening of The Green Line, the light rail line connecting Minneapolis and St. Paul, that represents our second light rail line and our third new rail service since 2004. As you can see, the staff complement that has grown the most is rail operations. Other staff complements have changed over that same period of time, many actually in relation to the growth of transit service. We'll have much more to say about any of that and all of that, but I do want to, just before I leave, it's important for us to let you know how not only important people are to our organization and the services we provide, but the capital that stands behind them as well. Both of these two big operations are very capital intensive, and they also require people to operate them. Of course, trains, buses, those are pretty obvious, but the folks who maintain and run our wastewater system. Both of these operations are among the most efficient in their peer group in the United States. We'll have a little bit more to say about each of those things, but we're in the top five or top four, depending on how you count it from a cost efficiency standpoint, thanks to the legislature and thanks to prior metropolitan councils. The aggregation of these two services in a regional setting has produced outstanding results for citizens. We have among the lowest wastewater rates at the property owner level in the United States. We have some comparisons that we'll show a little bit later. On the transit side of our operations, we're at probably number four or number fifth most efficient from a cost recovery standpoint and a subsidization standpoint on transit service overall among all the modes that are provided to the public. Those two efficiency measures are very important to us. We manage people and capital to achieve those two very important results. So I hope you keep that in mind, and I just want to say that at the outset. So we'll, I think it's up to the committee or the commission how it wishes to engage us with questions. We're prepared at any point, I think, to stop and take questions as we go along. I'm going to turn it over to Mary Bogie, our Chief Financial Officer, who will take you through some very high-level financial information, and then we'll turn to each of our divisions to give you a little bit more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As Pat said, my name is Mary Bogie, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council. I'm going to start our presentation with a council-wide perspective of our operating budget, our property tax levy, and our capital program. And then each of the operating divisions will come forward and provide you a little bit more detail on their own budgets. So just kind of a quick step back at our budget development timeline. To meet our statutes, on August 28th, our council adopted the preliminary operating budget and set our maximum property tax levy. After that date, we may change our budget, but we may not raise our levy amount. And while we're not statutorily required, we make that same commitment to our wastewater ratepayers. After we adopt the preliminary budget, we will not raise their wastewater rates. On November 13th, the council adopted a public comment draft of our budget, and I think Judd had emailed that to each of you. The council invites public comment on its budget until the final adoption of our budget at public meeting on December 11th. So with that, the slide I have before you shows the council's proposed 2014 operating budget, $888 million use of reserves, and breaks out our spending by operations, pass-through, and debt service. The pass-through programs include things like housing assistance, Livable Communities Act programs, I&I grants, inflow and infiltration, and the allocation of MVEST to suburban transit providers. On the sources side of our budget, the slide shows the primary funding sources. State revenues are a big portion, about a little over a third of our budget, and about little over $200 million of that is motor vehicle sales tax revenues. Charges for services are primarily wastewater fees and fares. This budget does not include a fare increase. The federal revenues shown there are about two-thirds housing assistance and about one-third transportation-related. And property taxes, while significant, represent only about 9% of our operating budget. The council's proposed payable 2014.
Representative Horst.
Just back to the earlier slide, the other is $54 million. What are some examples of other?
Mr. Chair and members, others may be local funding sources. We'll get into those a little bit more as we do the division presentations. So CTIB is a funder in that area. We have some property tax, or not, sorry, some transfers, fund transfers are in there. And also probably the biggest other source in there would be some uses of reserves. There's about $19 million use of reserves in our transportation division. That is a procedural item for us. So when we allocate our MVEST reserves, we budget 95% of the MVEST forecast. And then if we collect higher than 95% in the next budget cycle, we program that in. So $18 million is the transfer that we programmed in as it relates to use of reserves in our budget. So that would be the biggest piece.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might, on the same slide, what portion, if any, of the federal revenues are subject to sequestration?
Ms. Boogie.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm trying to think on the operating side, and I don't think any of the operating side is subject to sequestration. On our capital side, we do have some that is.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
The council's proposed payable 2014 property tax levy then is broken out on this next slide. Levy caps are established in statute for our non-debt service levies, and the total proposed non-debt service levies are $30.5 million, and we're about 10% under our levy cap of $34.3 million. That levy cap increases each year by the implicit price deflator, so government inflation. Debt service for parks and transit capital projects, represented by the green shaded areas of the pie, represent about 62% of our proposed levy. The debt service levies are not capped, but are instead limited by the bonding authority that is established in statute. Grant programs for livable communities, represented by the orange shaded slices, account for about 20% of our levy, and our general purposes levy primarily funds the administrative functions of regional administration and community development, and that's about 18% of our levy.
Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, please.
Mm-hmm. Senator Scott, that's fine.
Yeah,
Senator Scott. I'm sorry, Ms. Bogie, can you repeat again for me the portion of the property tax levy that is capped, what percent below that cap you're coming in under? Did you say 10%?
10%, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, thank you.
This next slide is a representation of where the metro area property tax dollars goes. And as you can see, counties, cities and towns, and school districts are by far the biggest portion of the metro area tax dollar. On the far right side, the orange slice there representing Metropolitan Council, we're about 2% of that metro area tax dollar. So it gives you kind of a size scope for where we fall. This slide as well shows the trend for changes to the property tax levy by metro area units of government. I will point to the black line with the orange diamonds there. That is the inflation or the for government. And the red line related at the bottom is the council levy, and it shows that the council levy since pay 2003 has increased 15.4%. The dotted line.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Bogie. Question for you. I'm sorry to go back on the debt service on the transit. I see that that's increased substantially. And what is that projected to increase even more, the debt service? That's a pretty big chunk of the budget. As we're
Mr. Chair and members,
building
Ms.
new lines.
We do have a slide later on in the presentation as it relates to the transportation outstanding debt as well as debt service. I would say that that is a pretty level debt service over the years of the CIP. There is a spike that we see in 2015, and that is related to some debt refunding that we did, and those funds are sitting in escrow to pay for those refundings.
So, Senator Dibble.
So just clarifying on Representative Scott's question, this 54% doesn't represent an increase, it just represents a portion of the property tax levy.
Mr. for Chair and members, that is correct.
Ms. Bogie. Any other questions? Ms. Bogie, continue.
Mr. Chair, I'll continue on with the slide. The dotted line at the bottom of the council line representing there shows what our tax levy would have been, but for those entities that chose to enter the transit taxing district. So the city of Ramsey, the city of Columbus, Lakeville, chose to come into the transit taxing district. So our base would have been that dotted line. With those additions, we had a 15.4% increase since pay 2003. And the lines above show those similar increases that were first seen in other areas of government. Indeed, we're under different operations than those areas, but meant to show how we relate. I'd like to shift gears now and talk about the council's capital program. There are three parts to the council's capital program, and I will highlight them on this chart. The first is the authorized capital program, and that's represented by the red bars on the chart. The authorized capital program includes all open capital projects, past, present, and future. Projects stay in the authorized capital program until they are closed or finished, and the projects are not put into the authorized capital program until funding has been secured for those projects. The capital improvement program, represented by the purple highlighted section there, is a six-year plan that includes both planned and authorized projects. The council's proposed capital improvement plan is $3.1 billion. The plan is based on anticipated revenues from existing revenue sources. The blue bars represent $2.2 billion, of planned projects. The funding for those projects has been identified, but not yet secured. As that funding becomes secured, we amend them into the authorized capital program. The capital budget represents...
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess might as well start asking the questions as the pages come along. So can you just itemize the projects then that are not included in the capital, anywhere in this capital program, capital improvement, that is? So is it nothing past Botno? Is that what?
Mr. Chair and members, the individual projects are listed in the proposed public comment draft that we sent out to you. I'm not prepared myself to talk about those individual projects, but each of the divisions can talk about projects in their areas.
All right.
So
thanks.
If that's okay, can we hold your question?
Thank you, Ms. Booth.
So this next slide shows the capital budget, and that's the one-year current year spending for the capital program. The highlighted area is that those projects that are authorized, $380 million, and then we expect the blue bar above to be amended into the program as those as funding is secured there. And most of the time, that's related to the different fiscal year of the federal government as well as state government. And until those appropriations are set, we don't amend them into our authorized program. As I said, the capital improvement program is a six-year plan in that we amend into the plan as funding becomes available. Today, as we talk to the divisions, they're going to focus on the six-year CIP portion of the capital program. This next slide shows the capital improvement program broken out by function. As I said, it's a $3.1 billion program and includes both authorized and planned projects. The left side of the pie chart shows breakout by division as well as a breakout for transitways because they're such a big part of the CIP. The major pieces of transitways are the New START federal programs for Central Corridor Light Rail and Southwest Light Rail. The right side of the pie chart shows the breakout between preservation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bogey, of the parks cap on the parks portion, is there any money included in that for additional purchase of land? And if so, how much?
Ms. Bogey.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, there is land acquisition included in the parks program. Mr. Peterson will be able to address the amount as he comes forward instead of having me page through to look at that. I don't have it up.
Okay.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and members, as I was saying, the right side pie chart breaks out by preservation, expansion, improvements, and again, transitways because they're such a big piece. Expansion projects in the CIP represent increased capacity, whether geographically or within our existing services. So in parks, that would include things like land acquisition. In environmental services, increased capacity by larger pipes to an existing service area or a new service area. And in transit, that would be things like additional buses for new or expanded service areas. Improvement projects are those projects in the CIP that improve our operating efficiency. Energy projects would be a good example of improvement projects. And finally, preservation is the main focus of the Council's capital improvement program. And but for the transitway projects, Southwest and LRT, Southwest LRT and Central Corridor, the preservation projects would represent 76% of the Council's capital improvement. This next chart shows how we finance the capital improvement program. I want to note again that not all funding sources have been secured and that projects are not authorized to spend until funding has been secured. The broken out purple slices at the purple and pink, I guess, slices at the top of the chart represent regional and borrowing anticipated over the 6 years of the CIP. Remember that the parks and transit bonds are repaid through the Council's Property Tax Levy Authority. The wastewater bonds are repaid by wastewater fees. Both the transit and the parks bonds match with state bond funds and federal funds. The wastewater bonds and a small PAYGO, again, are funded by wastewater fees.
Representative Scott.
Sorry to keep interrupting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bogey, I noticed, you know, that a large portion is like $1 billion out of $3 billion is coming from the federal government. What happens? Do you have a contingency plan if that funding doesn't materialize?
Mr. Chair and members, the majority of that federal funding is the New Starts funding for the light rail projects. And if the federal government wasn't to come through to fund those projects, my assumption would be those projects would delay or not be done.
Thank you.
And finally, Mr. Chair, my last slide shows the outstanding general obligation debt as of December 31st, 2012, $1.3 billion. The council is a AAA bond rating from both Moody's and Standard & Poor's. This slide shows by far the wastewater debt represents the largest of the council's outstanding debt, and that is the result of being the funding source for the capital program for wastewater, whereas Parks and Transit have other funding sources, state general obligation bonds, federal sources, the County Transit Improvement Board. Wastewater is funded entirely their capital program through a small payroll program, pay as you go, and our wastewater debt issuance. And with that,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Bogie, I'm going back to the previous page, but funding sources, you have a local and other, that's $145 million. And where is that local money coming from?
Mr. Chair and committee members, those local funding sources are primarily, again, related to transitway projects that go through communities. So the Hennepin County Regional Rail Authority, Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority, those are the types of sources that I include there in local other.
And Ms. Bogie, are those funds that, are those organizations, is that a discretionary number from them, or are we... are they transferring a certain percent of their funding, or how does that work?
Ms. Boogie.
Mr. Chair and members, that funding is based on the project costs, and so those organizations have committed to a portion of the funding of each of those projects, and that's how we come up with that number. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
Senator Dibbles.
Thanks. I wanted to ask about grant anticipation notes in the lower left-hand corner of this final slide. What are those, and how much in grant anticipation notes?
Mr. Chair and members, grant anticipation notes are related to the cash flow financing for the Central Corridor Light Rail Line. The federal government funds those projects on a reimbursement basis, and the appropriations are made year by year. And so we have a full funding grant award, and the grant anticipation notes that we issue are very short-term notes, 3 years long, that are anticipation of those federal revenues. They are not funded by the council's property taxes. They are funded by the receipts that we receive from the federal government and simply provide cash flow for that project.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Bogie, are there any pertinent, noteworthy recommendations from your most recent audit?
Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair and members, from our financial audit, which is prepared by the Office of the State Auditor, we had one comment in our management letter, and it was a repeat finding from the previous year. That finding has to do with better monitoring of our subrecipients of grant funds. The state auditor gave us credit for the amount of work we did in the 1 year and the changes that we implemented, and we are in the process of implementing a grants management system to help us with that grant monitoring as well. And so I expect that we will fully resolve that comment in our next financial audit.
Thank you.
Any other questions of this testifier?
Sure.
Representative Horn.
I guess I have a question that was a note I got that Representative Earhart had a particular question. I'm not sure I understand it, but I'll try to articulate it. Apparently, Ralph funds have been frozen. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I think you wanted some clarification about that, and no. Just putting that out there as a
Mr. Chair and committee members, RELF is our highway right-of-way loan fund, and I'm going to leave that question for when we present our transportation division, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
We did not levy in the current year for highway right-of-way, and we do have balances available in that fund. So I will let the transportation folks talk a little bit more about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
With that, Mr. Chair,
thank you very much.
We will move forward to community development.
Thank you for coming before this commission. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and commission members, my name is Guy Peterson. I'm the Community Development Division Director at the Metropolitan Council. The Council's Community Development Division is authorized and directed in Minnesota statutes to carry out several functions related to planning and funding. The division is lead staff in preparing the long-range plan for the region and preparation of the Metropolitan Development Guide, which for this 10-year cycle is being called Thrive MSP 2040. The Metro HRA administers federal and state rental housing assistance programs for low-income households. The division implements the Livable Communities Act, its regional parks and trails work guide planning for the region's park system, and distributes state and regional funding to grow and support the system. The division conducts research and including the official population estimates for the region and growth forecasts to support our long-range planning. And finally, we lead in the administration of the Land Planning Act that sets forth the local comprehensive plan relationship to regional plans. The division has a proposed budget of $99 million.
Representative Olberg, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Mr. Peterson, with your rental assistance, is that your HRA program that you're speaking of?
Mr. Chair, Peterson. Representative Holberg, yes.
And if I might, is it still true that not all seven counties are using your services for the administration of the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's correct. We only administer our program. The law only authorizes us to operate rental assistance programs in communities that don't operate their own through either their own local city program or through a county HRA or CDA program.
And Mr.
Representative
Chair, is it still Anoka and Dakota County that are doing their own?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it varies. Essentially, Dakota County does all of its own. Washington County has assistance programs, as does Scott County.
Representative Holberg.
Okay, and so I know this was a concern of mine in the past. Are the taxpayers the entire seven county metro area paying for the administrative costs of this program twice? In other words, if I'm a Dakota County resident paying taxes and we have our own program and I'm also being levied for the regional services of Metropolitan Council, am I paying twice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, all of the funding that supports our administration of the rental assistance programs is federal and state dollars.
Okay, and
Representative Holberg.
So I guess maybe as a state taxpayer, I'm paying twice. But with that program, I recall an article about the sequestration and the federal funds in the rental assistance program, and my prior question about sequestration funds and that portion of the operating budget. Can you tell me where that funding is denoted in these graphs?
Mr. Chair,
Peterson.
Representative Holberg, I noted that when you raised that question, I was going to address that. Yes, the sequestration has had implications for our Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. We have been engaged in attrition as people drop off the program. We have not been renewing their vouchers so that we will be able to manage what we anticipate will be about a 400 household reduction in our fiscal capacity to assist households, given the sequestration and the reduction of federal rent assistance that's going to be coming to us.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative
what
Holberg.
Portion of the total households served is 400?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Peterson,
Councilmember Holberg, Representative Holberg. We have 6,600 total households that we assist, so 400 to 450 is the ratio of the households that will be affected, of the program that will be affected.
Okay, and then if I might, just for clarification purposes, earlier when we were looking at the slide that denoted the federal funds as a part of the operating budget, are your federal funds in this quadrant of this graph, or is it somehow separate?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no, they would be represented in those figures.
So the answer before about not having sequestration issues, at least in the case of community development, we do have sequestration issues in the federal dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's correct.
Mr. Peterson.
And if I might, just one follow-up.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any other areas of your budget that are subject to sequestration? And if so, what plans are you making to deal with those?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Peterson.
Holberg. No other areas of our budget.
All right, thank you.
Okay, the division has a proposed budget of $99 million for 2014, 60% of which will come from the federal government and 27% of which will be from local property taxes. $82 million, or 83% of this $99 million, is proposed to be passed through to local government and to the 10 regional park agencies in the form of grants, and $55 million to landlords in the region in the form of rental assistance payments. And as I indicated, this is a reduction from the amount that we would normally have received prior to the sequestration.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, the grants, the pass-through grants, are those only for rental assistance, or are they for other things as well? And if they're for other things, what kind of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott,
Mr.
I will
Peterson.
Be going over some of that information,
okay.
But they're community development type grants, polluted site cleanup grants, and then the parks grants.
Okay.
Mr. Peterson, those grants that you're speaking of now, like for parks, are they in reaction to an application for grant, or is this a set of grants that have already been determined prior to this year?
Mr. Chair, the process is that the communities, it can be a combination of those types, but generally it is where they are prioritizing the local park. Agencies are prioritizing their needs, and the formulas determine the amount of dollars that they're granted.
Okay. Thank you.
Regarding this slide, approximately 12% of the $11.6 million of the CD division budget is for operation expenses. As you see by the chart on the left, more than one half is to be expended in the Metro HRA, and the balance in the four other units in the division. At the right, you see the salary and benefits will use 58% of the operating budget, and the bottom chart breaks down the sources of the $11.6 million. Implementation of the Land Planning Act of 1976 is one of the most important functions of the CD division and the council. The Metropolitan Development Guide and the regional systems plans provide guidance to local governments in preparing their local plans, which are required to be, by statute, to be completed by the last day of the eighth year of each decade. So 2018 is the next year in which local comprehensive plans will be due. The council reviews the plans for consistency with regional systems of transportation, wastewater, and regional parks. This slide sets forth the steps in the local planning process in the region. As it indicates, the council prepares the Metropolitan Development Guide and the systems plans. The local governments prepare the plans and prepare their local zoning and official controls to implement those plans. Since 1974, the council has had the authority to operate.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, just on that slide of sort of the process, to what degree are the policies developed within the Met Council versus, are you receiving directives in specific from the federal government on any of these policies?
Mr. Peterson.
Are there new ones?
Representative, well, no, essentially the policies are the policies of the Metropolitan Council. We prepare the systems plans and prepare the policies. I'm not going to suggest that there aren't policies in there that are affected by federal mm-hmm. funding, federal direction in some manner, but essentially they're the product of the Metropolitan Council in our process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Since 1974, the Council's had the authority to operate as a regional HRA for the purpose of administering rental assistance programs in cities that do not operate their own such programs or have a county HRA or CDA to do so. As I indicated earlier, currently our program assists 6,600 low-income households. This is assisting 18,000 people, and probably most importantly, 9,500 children that are able to live in safe, affordable, and decent housing because of our administration of these rental assistance efforts. From 1996 through August of this year, the Council has awarded 787 grants totaling more than $270 million in livable communities funds. These grants have and will continue to leverage billions of dollars in private and other public investments. This slide gives a breakdown for each of the three grant accounts, the demonstration account, the local housing incentives account, and the TBRA, which is our polluted site cleanup grant program, as well as the TOD category of LCA grants that we initiated in 2011, transit-oriented development grants that we initiated in 2011. This slide shows the investments leveraged with funds. In the case of the TBRA, it also adds the number of jobs that have been added and retained in the region and the net tax capacity that has been added because of this grant program.
Question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, the grant for the livable communities, the $5 million from HUD, were there any additional employees added as a result of that, and if so, how many? How many full-time employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I have to ask you to clarify. $5 million from HUD.
A three-year grant that you received from HUD. For livable communities, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah. Did that result in additional full-time employees at the Met Council? And if so, how many?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes. It resulted in one additional person and then another staff person that was paid for through the HUD grant monies.
Okay. Well, what exactly is the goal of the Sustainable Communities Grant? What's the ultimate goal of that grant?
Mr. Peters.
Chair, Representative. The goal of that was to get from the federal government and Sustainable Communities Program that was initiated under the Obama administration, was to have communities start to think regionally, think about all of the different actors and factors that affect regions of this country, primarily was to promote regional government because we are among only a few regions in the country that have regional government. And so it was an attempt to encourage metropolitan areas to start thinking regionally and incented that by making these dollars available for the regions to conduct and to put together long-range regional plans. The type of grant that we received was a different category, which was to help look at implementation activities for implementing the long-range regional plan that we already have in our metropolitan development framework.
And so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
So was part of that grant also used for what has now become known as Thrive 2040? Did that grant help develop that plan as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. Actually, no. We did not spend any of the monies from the $5 million on doing the Thrive plan, because essentially the Thrive plan was a revision of it was already something we would do by statute, a responsibility of the council. So we did not We deployed the monies from the $5 million grant for other kinds of activities in the region.
And is one of the goals...
Representative Scott.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's been a while since we've been all sitting around these tables. Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson, so would you say that one of the goals of the livable communities and this whole region idea of further regional development is to place low-income housing out in other areas than the urban core?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I would say that certainly one of the impetus for it is to provide housing and economic opportunity for people throughout the region to have a choice, have the opportunity to secure affordable housing, a secure job, have access transportation that provides them access to jobs and services. So yes, that's one of many goals and aspirations of the HUD Sustainable Program, Sustainable Communities Program.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Scott.
What I'm afraid is going to happen here is we're going to have this carrot and stick approach of in communities that if you don't put low-income housing and high-density housing in your community, that you're going to be deprived of other things from the Met Council, such as transportation dollars for those sorts of things. And that's what, you know, it seems to be happening here, and I just wondered if you could give me any comfort that that's not the goal.
Mr. Peterson. Chair, Representative, I wouldn't say that it's the goal. Certainly, communities' efforts to be receptive to affordable housing, to try and diversify their housing stock in terms of affordability and type of housing, is a factor that is looked at in decisions about all of our funding of our dollars through the Livable Communities Program, certainly.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Peterson, if a community says, you know, we don't want to put this high-density housing in, will the Met Council then say, well, then you're not going to get X amount for your transportation dollars? Is that something that could happen?
Mr. Chair, Peterson. Representative Scott, I don't see that happening, no.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hartman.
Thank you. Thank you. A question. Can you just explain briefly the purpose and the operation of the tax-based revitalization account and how it relates to fiscal disparities, if at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator, tax-based revitalization account program is $5 million that comes from the fiscal disparities pool. Through the council uses those dollars to make grants to cities for cleaning up polluted sites or remediating buildings that need to remove asbestos or lead-based paint so that all of these properties can be redeveloped, rejuvenated, put back on the tax rolls, create jobs and tax base in communities.
Sure.
Senator Hartman.
Are the cities the ones that make the determination as to where those funds will be used, and do they take a vote on those decisions?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, the applications are from city governments.
And so they're passing resolutions in support of using those funds for those particular purposes?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they are.
Thank you.
Again, with that one. I've already talked about the pass-through portion of the division's budget for next year. This slide breaks down categories a little more specifically. On the right, you can see the HRA rental payments at $55 million, the LCA demonstration account, which is what I just talked about, Senator, the demonstration account, $11.3 million. The TBRA account that I just talked about is $5.4 million for polluted site cleanup. And then parks operation and maintenance, $8.5 million in grants. In 1974, the Metropolitan Parks Act outlined the role of the council vis-a-vis regional parks and trails. The slide outlines there for you the activities that entails in creating a regional parks policy plan, reviewing and approving master plans, preparing parks capital improvement program, issuing council bonds as matched to state geo bonds and other funds, and pass through regional parks operations funds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, just going back to my question about the staffing for that HUD grant, the $5 million, on page D4 of the unified budget, it talks about staffing, and in there it mentions that it says this reflects a 5-position reduction from the 80 authorized in 2013 stemming from the conclusion of a 3-year HUD Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant. And so are we talking you said you added 2 full-time equivalents. So explain to me what these 80 are. I just need clarification because there's a big difference there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we had moved some other folks to do supportive activities for quarters of opportunity from the existing staff we already had. And so now they're going to stay with that group of folks in terms of the FTEs that are going to then move over to be in the TOD office. So it wasn't the addition of people.
You're just moving people around.
We had FTEs, we had staff, and we're reducing our overall size of the community development division.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Peterson, on the slide that you were just covering here, where it says review and approve master plans, are those the ones that are submitted by counties, or are they city, or is there another municipal organization that submits?
Mr. Chair, those are plans they are submit. They are, if they're a county parks agency, then it's a plan prepared by the county, such as Dakota County, Scott mm-hmm. County. There are also Minneapolis and St. Paul are part of the regional park system, too. So those park entities would submit their master plans.
And at what time do you become involved to review them?
Mr. Chair, after they've gone through their local process, okay. they send the plan through the Parks and Open Space Commission for review and then through the council for reviewing any kinds of revisions that are done to the master plans.
Mm-hmm. And I guess specifically, you don't review them at the draft stage. You review them after the county has approved them.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But obviously, we work closely with Parks Implementing Agency staff. They understand our policies. We answer questions. We work collaboratively with them so that the work they're doing as they prepare or more often make amendments or revisions to their master plan that we're in sync with one another as it moves through the process then.
Okay. Thank you. So, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad you asked that. I wanted to actually explore that bullet. But when it says review and approve master plans, are these master plans for planning for the overall planning for these individual park agencies, or master plans only as they relate to the regional park, the portions of their system that are designated as part of the regional parks?
Mr. Chair, Senator, they're only for the particular park that they're talking about. Within their park system, they may have 5 regional facilities,
right.
And obviously a master plan. Each one has a master plan for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, thank you. How many implementing agencies are there? Is it 10 now, or are there?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, 10.
Okay. Just for the benefit of the public, because we're speaking in a fairly specific language here, we don't have a regional park system per se. We have the 10 kind of local park systems that comprise with portions of their systems stitched together the regional system. For example, Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, Minneapolis's park system has some of its larger parks, like Lake Calhoun, are designated part of the regional system. So we don't have a regional park agency per se, and then all that activity is coordinated through Parks and Open Space Commission, capital and programming.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're on that subject, I had asked previously about land acquisition for parks, and I just wondered if you could elaborate. It looks like 7% of the proposed capital improvement plan goes to parks, $207 million. And so what portion of that 7% will be used in percentage and dollar amount, if you have it, for land acquisition?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I have that in my next slide.
Super.
Question from Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, just a quick one. Senator Dibble mentioned that there were 10 park systems that comprise the regional system. I'm just curious what those are. I mean, he mentioned Minneapolis parks. I assume Three Rivers parks, maybe Ramsey County parks. Is it just sort of county park systems generally for in the 7-county area?
Yes. Mr. Anoka Peterson. County, Washington County, Dakota County, Scott County, Carver County, Three Rivers, Ramsey County, did I say Ramsey, and Hennepin, and Minneapolis and St. Paul. Okay. I think I had all of them.
Okay. Mr. Please continue.
These pie charts address total capital spending for the 2014 through 19 period, which is projected to be $207 million. The uses by department chart illustrates that $161 million of those funds are allocated to park agencies under statutory and policy formulas. Acquisition grants, which are authorized on a request basis for park agencies, will consume $45 million. The uses by category chart illustrates that $49 million will be used to acquire land for the regional park system in the expand label. So, Representative Scott, that's the answer to your question. $81 million is projected to be used to construct new park and trail facilities under the improve label, and $77 million is projected to be used to preserve existing park and trail infrastructure. The sources of the park CIP funded are state appropriations, and you can see it in that bottom pie chart, about $163 million or 79% from state appropriations, and regional bonds finance 21%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, what thinking guides the direction of this area, the parks? I mean, is it an estimated population that the metro will reach at a certain time? Is it, I mean, how do you decide it's time to build more and expand more? Is it unlimited?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly wouldn't say that it's unlimited. It is a process of working with the local parks implementing agencies, the regional, those 10 agencies, if they're deciding that they want to expand a facility or create a new one. There's, you know, the process is engaged in at the local level first, and then it has to fit into the regional system discussion. And certainly the issue of fiscal capacity to be able to address the needs of expanding of the system and operating and maintain it comes in those kinds of decisions when the system plan is looked at and changes are discussed.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sort of following on that, Mr. Peterson, then, in terms of the system, park system, I mean, the legacy costs, I mean, do you factor that in at all, the costs of pensions and operations and maintenance going forward? And at a certain point, you know that you're at capacity, or, I mean, does that get looked at every budget cycle? Where does that come into the planning picture?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not an expert in that area, but I think that most of it is comes out of the local decision-making process at the local level of the expansion of their systems in their own jurisdiction, of the parks in their own jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. They have to make those kinds of operation and maintenance decisions.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, just for members' information, we have some really good discussion here, but we do have a hard drop dead date at 2:30 that we have to adjourn by. So I'm not sure how far we are in your presentation.
We're very close.
Oh, I see we have a lot of charts and a lot of numbers ahead of us. So
no,
if there's any questions that can be taken offline, I'd appreciate it too.
Okay. This map shows that $207 million would be spent geographically among the 10 regional park implementing agencies. State law and council policy allocates the capital spending among the park agencies under formulas. These formulas consider the population of that park agency's jurisdiction. the amount of sites visits, the amount of visits the agencies host, the amount of land they manage, and the amount of money they spend to operate and maintain their part of the regional system. So there's a variety of factors and formulas that go into the distribution of the dollars, and these are all worked through in agreement and collaboration with all of the park entities.
I have one question on that. When we talk about the number of visitors versus the mission of that particular park, if we're looking at, for instance, preservation of wilderness parks, which by its nature doesn't have a lot of visitors, is that somewhere in the formula so that the parks that people want to preserve as wild and nature parks, where they can make sure that they get an appropriate amount to, for their type of preservation.
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
It's okay. Thank you.
And finally, the council issues 5-year bonds to meet cash flow needs for the Regional Park Acquisition and Capital Projects grants. State law limits the amount of outstanding bonds to $40 million at any point in time. The outstanding debt bars on this graph illustrate the cumulative amount of outstanding bonds remaining to be paid off each year, actual to 2013 and projected from 2014 through 2019. So, Mr. Chair and Commission members, that concludes my portion of the presentation.
Thank you very much. Any wind-up questions here from the Commission? Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Commission. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Chair and committee members, my name is Lisa Thompson, and I'm the General Manager of Environmental Services. As you all know, our region is richly blessed with great water resources, and as the pictures on our opening slide here depict, our three roles all relate to water. We have our first responsibility depicted by the center picture. 75 years ago, the region constructed the first major wastewater treatment facility on the Mississippi River. And today that's still our flagship facility in meeting our wastewater treatment role, which is our primary responsibility. Our second responsibility is surface water resource management, and that's intended to protect and improve the water quality of our rivers, lakes, and streams in the region. And we do that in a couple of ways. We provide technical assistance to the communities and the watersheds. We monitor and report on the quality of those water bodies. And finally, we do provide review and input to community plans that will affect those water bodies. Our third responsibility is water supply. We've had some responsibility since 1988 on water supply, but that ramped up more significantly with the legislation in 2005. Which then charged the council with developing the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Plan. The goal for that plan is to make sure that we have a sustainable water supply for current and future generations of this region. That legislation also created an advisory committee that's representing localities and state agency with roles in water supply. Our water supply role includes providing technical assistance and groundwater modeling so that we can project what the future will look like based on usage patterns. The first water supply report was published in 2010, and the next one is due in 2015.
Question from Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Lisa.
Thompson. Thank you. There's been some hubbub up in Anoka County and around in that area about this whole issue of water. We have several aquifers and so forth in our area. And, you know, you mentioned the projections, and I'm just curious about how you come up with some of the numbers, and not just for water usage, but for across the metro area. Maybe this is a question for someone else, too, but... for instance, Hugo, they were projecting all this use, and then they've had to back off of that, that Hugo is not going to grow at the anticipated rate that it was. Yeah, and I know there are a lot of cities and local units of government that are very concerned about the Met Council's numbers projections in projecting what the future population is going to look like. So I just wonder if you might address some of how you arrive at some of the projections that you mentioned.
So we...
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, committee members. We're still in the process of putting together more of the details of the model, but the model will reflect what the communities are reporting in terms of their plans for water usage and the population that they're going to serve, but it puts it all together in a regional perspective, and it adds to that what's the capacity and the facts around our aquifer supplies and how much of a drawdown is going on. So it reflects the entire picture when we take all of the region's plans and uses together. And that's an unfinished product at this point.
Ms. Thompson, please continue.
Consistent quality of our wastewater treatment mission is demonstrated with the fulfillment of our permit requirements, and that's a 24/7, 365 days out of the year commitment to the region to protect the public's health and the environment. The industry benchmark for permit compliance is the Platinum Award, which is presented by the National Association of Clean Water Agencies. And it goes to facilities that have had perfect permit compliance for 5 years or more in a stretch. Six of our seven facilities are above that consecutive five-year mark. Four of our wastewater facilities are ranging from 5 years to 12 years of consecutive compliance, and two are in the over 20-year range. So I'm particularly proud of our staff who've established such a strong tradition of maintaining our permit compliance. We've also been recognized for safety, for our strength of our programs. We have several facilities with zero accidents, and since the last decade, our accidents have dropped by more than half. So we're really proud of the efforts of keeping our employees safe. We've had a couple of governor's awards that we're also thrilled to have gotten. One represents a key important role for us, which is to collaborate and partner with others in the community. And our continuous improvement award on the Interagency Clean Water Fund was just that. We were working with others and providing substantial results. And the last one was about energy. We've been on a quest to reduce our energy consumption since 2006, and we're quite proud of that as well. We're actually at over 20% with meeting our reduction, and we are planning to get to 50% by 2020. So it's fairly ambitious, but staff are really energized behind that goal, and I'm confident we're going to meet it. This graphic provides a perspective on our costs. The last one is on our quality. This is on our costs. The comparison information that you see here is obtained from the National Association of Clean Water Agencies, and they perform a financial survey of its members on a triennial basis. So this is the latest results from released in 2012. What you're seeing here is the average retail sewer charges per household for the reporting agencies that are in what we consider our peer group, which is larger facilities that are treating more than 100 million gallons per day. So you can see our costs compared to the others and how it stacks up. Our average retail rate is $216, and the peer average is $393. That ranks us fifth lowest of the 24 reporting agencies. The previous survey, we also were fifth, so we're staying in a pretty nice spot for us to be.
Sure. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, when did Washington, D.C. move to Canada?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, let him have a mayor.
I know this.
Mr. Freiberg.
Sure, thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
I know Mr. Bohr at the outset said that the think he said there was the lowest wastewater rates for homeowners. This is the number he was referencing, is the $216 here? Is that correct?
$216 is our cost. We're about 40% below the national average for peer agencies.
Does that include things such as when residents have to make improvements to their sewer lining because of issues with inflow and infiltration?
No, this would be our
Ms. Thompson.
Cost for operating the wastewater.
Oh, just on a per capita basis?
It does, Mr. Chair, it does include local city costs that have been added to it. So we wholesale it to the community, and they add their local cost to it. So it would be whatever community costs, so that it ends up to be what the homeowner pays for their sewer fees. So it's a combination.
Okay. Question from Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it used to be, and I don't know if this is still the case, that the expansion of the system was paid for by WAC and SAC fees, and that the operating was paid for what I believe are these rates that you're reflecting here on the chart. And when the recession took a turn, the growth projections that Met Council had based their expansion of their system on were far too aggressive, and there wasn't enough money coming in from new hookups, et cetera, and ran into some problems with that model of paying for the expansion. And can you refresh us as to what steps were taken, and then give us a little update in how the permits are coming in now, and we'll be able to go to a lesser cost, or kind of the big picture story around the costs of the wastewater infrastructure relative to the new development.
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think there was a couple questions in there, so if I miss one of your questions, I'll try and answer. The sewer availability charge is for future growth and expansion. And it's true that as the economic picture was downturned, that we didn't have as much of that as we typically would have. And so for a period of time, we actually had to pay our debt service using our current wastewater fees. We've since, SAC has already turned around, and that was like a temporary loan. So that's being paid back now by the SAC units that are being bought. And so that's focused on future growth. We do pay as part of our operating budget, and you'll see that in a future slide, so maybe I can answer part of it now and rest of it later. We do include within our rates payment on debt service. So our rates do reflect that portion.
And
Representative Holbert.
If I might, given that you stated that there's some turnaround, where's the balance, or how do you see, are we going to go back to the old model of paying for this soon? You said we were paying back and that SAC was almost even. Can you explain that a little more thoroughly?
So
Ms. Thompson.
The portion that was being paid by our current municipal wastewater charges, SAC is now picking up those costs, and it's no longer coming out of that portion. And an additional, some of the wastewater rates are supplemented by payback from the SAC. So it's returning to its original source.
So if I might, did we see a reduction in rates then, now that the users are back to not paying for the expansion costs, if you will?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Thompson.
And committee members, that's correct. Our budget reflects payback from SAC to the wastewater rates.
And is there a corresponding rate reduction to the payers? I mean, if we raised rates because we weren't getting in the new development in order to pay our debt of our expansion of our system that was based on more housing units than actually came to be. So we started charging the current users when we didn't do that before as a matter of policy. Are we, when you say we're back, I understand the payment back to the operating or the user fund versus the expansion fund. I know I'm not using the right terms here. So did we see a rate reduction? I mean, you should have a twofold thing in that you're paying back and that your growth is up. So has there been a rate reduction to the current users?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't have the specific percentage that it has impacted our cost as a result of that, but I could get that for you. And it has kept our new projection is lower as a result of that transfer. I just don't have the specifics in terms of how much that impact is, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thompson, somewhere in the budget here it talks about concerns over the MPCA making more stringent water quality standards, and I'm just wondering how that might affect your overall budget if you've taken that into account, and also what that might mean to communities and people paying the bills, homeowners.
Can you hold on for three slides?
Yep.
Mr.
Yep,
Chair,
sure.
And committee members. Our three largest revenue sources, the green area you can see, municipal charges for wastewater treatment. Those are charges back to the communities based on flow. We have a portion that comes from industries who we charge directly, and that's based on their flow and strength. And then we also have the sewer availability charges, and that's for new service connections. There's a couple small categories that I'll give you a quick read on what those are. The state revenue source is comprised of the legacy clean water funds, and that's for water supply work. And 2012 bond-funded municipal I&I grants that we pass through to communities, qualifying communities, so that's a pass-through. And then there's a small slice called other revenue source, and because we have a top-notch environmental lab, we do provide some laboratory analysis for other agencies, watersheds, and the like. And we get some water monitoring grants, investment earnings, miscellaneous things, very small amount. Our two largest uses, operations comprises 56% of our budget. And as you'll see, because we're a very large infrastructure-heavy organization, our debt service is 43%. Our debt service does compare favorably with similar organizations or peer organizations. Specifically, our debt per capita is the sixth lowest of our peer group. So we're, and it's taken into account in our rates. So we feel like we're in good standing with our percentage of debt service. The pass-through piece is, again, the grants that go to the communities for I&I.
Ms. Thompson, I have to ask, when you said we have the sixth lowest of our peer group, how big is the peer group?
That's that same group that you were seeing on the map.
National group?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is our operating budget. You can see here that on our revenue side, 98% of our revenue comes from 105 municipalities and 800 industries, and that's our municipal wastewater charges. In terms of our operating focus from 2013 to 2014, they look very similar. We haven't had any major focus shifts. So if you were to look at our last budget versus this budget, all those use categories are within 1% to 2% of our previous year. And that's within 1% to 2% of what our NACWA peers seem to have split between chemicals and labor and their costs as well. uses by department. I think one thing of note here is to emphasize the significance of our core wastewater treatment operation. There's a 9% slice that's labeled EQA. That is the area where our water supply and our surface water work comes funding out of that, so it's less than that 9%. So pretty much everything else is for operating our 7 wastewater treatment plants, as well as our interceptor system, which conveys it from the communities to our 7 plants. Turning to our CIP, the first pie chart illustrates that currently our interceptor system is our primary program focus. And again, this is the pipes that convey the wastewater from the communities to our plants. The category pie chart demonstrates that preservation is currently our primary category of work. Preservation is a growing focus at this point, and there will be some other slides that will illustrate why that is the case. But for comparison, last CIP, last year, it was 58% focus on interceptors. Now you can see we're at 73. And on preservation, we were at 68, and now we're at 83. And those are both significant increases or focus. They get a flavor for what that preservation includes. That 83% includes 90 miles of pipe and 20 lift stations, which are help get the wastewater through the pipes and to our plants. The 12% expand category includes 3 miles of pipe and 5 lift stations that are for growth or expansion. So you'd see much less focus on expansion, much more focus on preserving what we have. The 5% improvement projects, they include things like improving air emissions and reducing what we put out into our air and that we breathe, as well as odor control improvements and energy conservation and recovery. Primary financing, 2 sources. Public Facilities Authority loans represent 29%, and 63% is council-issued bonds. Might want to point out that we also have a pay-as-you-go slice that we're growing by approximately 2% per year, and in future years you're going to see that bringing our debt service down. So we're taking some more proactive stance to making sure our debt service doesn't get bigger. We would like to see it get smaller.
Representative Scott, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us an idea of, you know, $833 million for capital improvement projects? Are there some, like, really large projects that are, you know, within this number that you could kind of give us an idea what those are?
I will highlight 3 projects in 2 more slides.
We have it again. Okay, thank you.
Okay, this slide will get a little bit at that regulatory question. Our risks and our pressures fall primarily into 3 categories. Our first risk is the ongoing potential for changes in our regulatory requirements. And what we could see on the horizon at this point pertain to things that relate to that hypoxic zone in the Gulf and Lake Pepin's concerns. So we're looking at phosphorus, nitrogen, and we've already done a lot to remove phosphorus from our discharges, but there's potentially more that we'd have to do around nitrogen. The difficulty about that is if we remove more nitrogen, it tends to bring up phosphorus. So we're already doing research trying to figure out if we're going to bring down nitrogen, how can we do it in the most cost-effective way and with the least amount of detriment to the environment. So we're always looking for less chemicals, more natural processes. And so we're already working to look at that possibility, anticipating that would come. What gets hard for us is if the regulators say, we need it and we want it right now. And oftentimes that means you have to go and build something that's more expensive. At this point, we're really optimistic. We are working on multiple fronts with not only our regulating community, but our community partners. And we're trying to stay ahead of that curve so we don't have to do any of those quick, higher cost implementation. Our second
Senator Dibble question.
a question about this nitrogen issue. I understand this is, you know, the sanitary sewers that we're talking about, but, you know, this issue of nitrogen nitrogen in our surface waters has increased rather dramatically in the last number of years, and there's, you know, of course, the big PCA report that came out this last summer. I haven't read it yet, I confess. But, of course, it's from agricultural practices that have changed over the last 10 to 15 years. And it's pretty dramatic, and, of course, it dramatically affects water quality, like Pepin and the hypoxic zone in particular. How much of what we're dealing with the Met Council water treatment is attributable to agriculture?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair and Council Member, your question is how much of wastewater is part of the nitrogen?
Yeah, I mean, how much has the nitrogen problem increased recently that Met Council has to deal with, and how much do we know how much is attributable to ag practices?
Mr. Chair and committee members, at this point, we don't have a responsibility to reduce nitrogen. We anticipate that there's a likelihood we will be asked to. So that would become part of our permit discharge requirements. So to be in compliance, we would have to lower our current discharge. So this is hypothetical enough that we don't have a specific answer to that question at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Our second area of concern or risk is asset preservation. And while we have taken a more aggressive approach, as you can see in the previous slides, we're still evaluating whether, this is the right amount and at the right pace. Pipes are susceptible to corrosion, and materials are susceptible to failure, and you always have soils that add to that. So as soon as you put a pipe in the ground, it basically starts to decay in some respect. And the reason that's so important is climate change. This September, the EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy provided an update on the Climate Action Plan, and she noted that much of what climate change is about is water, and whether our aging water and wastewater treatment facilities will respond well. When they're overstressed and flooded during the extreme weather events, do they have the resiliency that's needed for those events? So we're paying very close attention to that. Part of the reason you're seeing some increase, we've accelerated some of our plans on preservation, thinking we're going to reduce some of that risk, knowing that climate change is a concern.
Mr. Chair?
A question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that theme, the sewer water main breaks, I guess, that have been occurring in Minneapolis, do you monitor then the number of sewer main breaks that are occurring, and is the system itself, which you control, is it? Is that a Minneapolis responsibility, or is that yours, and where is that all going to come out of your budget?
Mr. Chair, committee members. Oftentimes it gets to be confusion about whether it's ours or theirs. When the most recent breaks that have been reported on have been drinking water breaks, so we only deal with the wastewater piece. Okay. And we have a very extensive system where we're monitoring and alarming 24/7, 365 days a year that there is no interruption in the flow or leak.
Thank you.
So here's a highlight on three projects. These are interceptor projects, and they are new projects that you are represented in that CIP pie chart that I had on the previous two slides. We have an Elm Creek project, which is in District 1, and that's going to close out the phased improvements that began almost a decade ago. And that will serve the Elm Creek watershed communities of Brooklyn Park, Dayton, Maple Grove, Medina, Plymouth. And again, this is a combination of serving the growth that's already in place and planned, as well as preserving what we have. A second one is in Bloomington. That's in District 5. It'll provide a new lift station And that was determined that based on condition assessment, it was time that it needed to be replaced. And that's at, located near 494 and Normandale Boulevard. And our third significantly sized project is in the North Area Interceptor, and that's, again, rehabilitation. Recent inspections revealed corrosion damage, and it signaled it was time to put those facilities on track for rehabilitation. And that project will encompass interceptors in Blaine, Brooklyn Park, Champlin, Circle Pines, Coon Rapids, Forest Lake, Fridley, Hugo, Lexington, Lionel Lakes, Moundsview, Shoreview, and Spring Lake Park. So the blue bars are debt outstanding. And you can see there is some increase in those, and that is attributed to our desire to move our preservation along at a faster pace. Whether we'll be able to accomplish that or not, you can see our level of spending prior to 2016. We're not expanding our staff. We're just going to try and deliver projects on a faster pace. So we hope that we'll be able to do that. That is our goal. If we don't, we won't spend quite that much. The red line is our debt service, and again, that is included in our operating budget, so we think our rates reflect that in terms of competitiveness with other wastewater utilities. If there aren't any questions, I think I'm ready to turn it over to our next presenter.
Thank you very much. We'll remind our testifiers and commission that members that we have 20 minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll start. My name is Arlene McCarthy. I'm Director of Transportation Services at the Met Council. I'll start and then turn it over to Ed Petrie, who's here for Metro Transit.
Welcome to the commission.
Thank you. First, I wanted to answer Representative Hornstein's question about Ralph that was asked earlier. RALF is the Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund. It is used for highway projects. The concept is that there's an early acquisition by a local entity, usually a city, of property that will be needed for a highway project that is off into the future and is not yet funded. And the purpose is that you would anticipate the cost of the property would only grow in the interim, and so we buy the properties at the lower cost, and then it is reimbursed at that lower cost when the project is funded. Usually these are MnDOT projects. A while back, a couple years ago, the council did put the RALF program on a hiatus because they wanted to just review the program, although they did allow for any urgent situations to be brought forward by communities, and they said they would entertain them. In this time, we have not had any requests come forward. We were anticipating actually a couple parcels for the Trunk Highway 610 project to come forward, but however, with the Corridors of Opportunity announcement last week, that project being funded, these parcels will not need to go through the RALF program. So we do have a good balance in the RALF program today. So, Mr. Chair, now moving on to our presentation. One of the council's transportation roles is to be what's called the MPO. This is a federal requirement. Any large region receiving a lot of federal money must have an MPO. And you can see our purposes there. The first one is the long-range transportation policy plan. And you'll recall Mr. Peterson talked about the council issuing system statements. The transportation policy plan is the system statement for transportation. We also have the TIP, which is a four-year plan of funded projects. We receive federal funding through MnDOT for what we call the Unified Planning Work Program. And then we also, in our MPO role, participate in major transportation studies for all modes here in the region. The Transportation Advisory Board, which is a 33-member board, 17 members are local elected officials. The other three are appointed, such as citizen reps. They allocate the federal funds that are given to the MPO, and they do that through a solicitation process every couple years. Right now they're in the in the process of reviewing their solicitation process and making good progress on that. And then another responsibility of the MPO is to ensure that there's good public participation in the planning activities. Here you can see the transit providers. Metro Transit operates these regular route services of bus, the Hiawatha or Blue Line light rail, the North Star commuter rail, and they will be operating next year the Green Line or Central Corridor light rail when it opens approximately mid-year in 2014. And then they also provide quite a bit of regional support to all the transit providers. In my department of Metropolitan Transportation Services, we operate through competitively procured private contractors, the Metro Mobility or federally mandated ADA service, as well as a transit link general public dial ride. That is offered where regular route does not exist. So that tends to be out in the more rural parts of the seven county metro. We contract about 5% of the region's bus service to private contractors. We operate a subsidized van pool program, and then we fund the Red Line, and we have a contract with Minnesota Valley Transit Authority to operate that. We also pass through funds to the suburban transit providers. You can see them listed there. MVTA represents five cities of Burnsville, Savage, Eagan, Apple Valley, and Rosemount. And Southwest Transit is a JPA of three cities that are Eden Prairie, Chaska, and Chanhassen. Ridership, of course, is the premier measure of a transit success. And so you can see here that last year we had 94 million rides. That's over 250,000 rides a day. The service, 3.4 million hours of service. And we have a very good, from a national comparison perspective, fare recovery of 28%. That means on average the fares cover 28% of the operating costs. I have another slide that shows you a breakdown by the different types of service because there is quite a range. And the average subsidy per passenger, in other words, what the fare box does not cover, is just under $3 per passenger trip. On the pie chart, you can see how the ridership is broken down. The bus system accounts for the majority of our ridership.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $2.94 subsidy per passenger, I'm guessing that's average and it's per ride. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, yes, that is correct.
Per one way.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Where does all that money come from, the subsidy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Petrie will get into our funding sources in his charts.
Question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed you have a lump sum number for light rail here, but I'm interested in the fare recovery specifically on North Star Commuter Rail. Mm-hmm. And I've looked ahead a few slides in case I was getting ahead of myself again. Yeah. I don't see that. I don't see a breakdown for, that's just operations. Can you tell me what the fare recovery on North Star is?
Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, it is ahead on a few chairs. For commuter rail, it's 17.3%. That's just ahead a few slides. We'll get to a chart on that.
Okay. Because I thought I saw some part of the budget or something that was lower than that. But
Mr. Chair, it might be the various years of statistics.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Question from Chair. Representative Runbeck.
Maybe this is the appropriate page. Is there a further breakdown that you could provide us on which systems are delivering, you know, what total numbers of rides? I mean, you know, I'm interested in buses in relation to the total, and is that growing? Is that shrinking? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And now that we have, I guess we're going to be, you know, we have several years worth of Hiawatha and so on. We'll be able to see where those numbers are.
Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair, we have, of course, very good historical data on our ridership for all the modes, and we produce that every year. And we have some information here, but if it doesn't meet your needs, we are happy to provide you whatever you would like, and we could work with your staff to make sure we understand your request and provide that to you.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, this chart here just shows some of our fair payment tools that really help to promote ridership on all modes of transit. I will just highlight, I think you're familiar probably with the Metro Pass, the U Pass, and the College Pass, which have been around a little bit longer. I'll highlight the bottom one, which is the Student Pass, the most recent fare tool. That was started in 2011 with Minneapolis Public Schools joining in 2012. At present, there are 11 schools with representing 1,500 students participating in this. So as with all of our passes, while maybe the motivating purpose was to get the students to and from school, they can use it on all, it has an unlimited usage. So many of them do use it to get to work, to jobs, for other things.
Question from Representative Scott.
Does this, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this data here that you have on this page include, it's a combination of train and bus usage?
Mr. McCarthy. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct. It's rides on the entire public transit system.
All right, thank you.
Here is a summary level slide of our regional transit ridership. Again, it demonstrates that the regular route bus system still will continue to carry the majority of our rides. Metro Transit Rail, which is today the blue line, Hiawatha, along with North Star Commuter Rail, is what you see in yellow. And then all of the other programs, which are summarized at the bottom of that chart, are in red. We have an increase in 2013, a modest increase that we're anticipating by year end based on current ridership. And then you'll see there's a bump in 2014. And that is primarily in anticipation of the Green Line opening in mid-2014. And that's what we anticipate an increase in ridership. So this slide, I think, speaks to some of your earlier questions about the different modes. We have the subsidy per passenger. You can see there's quite a range there, light rail being the lowest at $1.50 for each trip. And then on the high end is our Metro Mobility ADA service with a subsidy of just under $23 a ride. And that is normal across the country. I think you all know that the ADA service and the Dial-A-Ride are more door-to-door type services. We do schedule multiple people on a trip as we can, but they, of course, are much lower volume type trips compared to the regular route services.
Question from Senator Scalzi.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noticed the Dial-A-Ride subsidy at $18.51 versus the urban local of $2.34. And as you know, I always bring up my city of Vadnais Heights because you did mention that Dial-A-Ride is typically in a rural area. But Vadnais Heights is a city of 12,000 people, just 8 miles north of where we sit today. So when does the Met Council decide that, or Met Transit, decide that Dial-A-Ride is much too expensive for such a close-in city, and maybe there should be a local bus going through that city?
Mm-hmm. Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, there is a process. In fact, last week Metro Transit held some public meetings to get input in developing what's called the Regional Service Improvement Plan. And that's where they put on the table ideas for regular route service. Where should service be expanded? And they get input from all of the local entities. And then all of the transit providers do this, so the suburban transit providers participate also. And then they come together, and there's a lot of evaluation criteria that go into it where they look at and anticipate ridership that would occur on a regular route. And so there are times where they go through their process and they do add local service. And sometimes we put local service in and it performs okay. And there are other times where it does not perform adequately, so then we pull it back. But they look at, we have quite a bit of information from census data. We know how many, you know, what the population is in general, where people are going to work. The majority of our riders are going to and from work or school. So we do have quite a bit of data that helps us make those decisions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
The cost per ride is not on this chart. I see the $2.94 was the subsidy per passenger. That was the average, but I don't see the
cost per ride, either as an average or for each of the different types? Do you have that information?
Ms. McCarthy.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, if I understood you, you mean not the subsidy, but the total cost to deliver. Yes, we
right.
have that, so we can provide that to your staff to distribute.
I would appreciate it. I think that's really important, is how much it actually costs, not just the subsidy.
Thank you. We'll provide that. Just to highlight on the fare recovery, again, you'll remember from a previous slide, our average is 28% fare recovery. And you can see, again, there's a range here. The highest fare recovery is the express service at about 44%. And, yes, and these are for 2011. And then the lowest fare recovery is for the general public dial ride.
And, Ms. McCarthy, how do you designate the hours that are used in that productivity figure? For instance, the commuter rail being 180 passengers per hour. Is that per operational hour, or is there what's the hours that are used?
Mr. Chair, that's what we call in-service hours. So when you look at a schedule, it's all the hours, for example, North Star, when that train is in operation and available to the public. And then we take the total passengers provided and divide it by the hours.
Okay. Okay. So 24 hours would be vastly different number for each of these.
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be vastly different.
But now the dial-a-ride and the dial-a-ride, how do you figure those hours? Is that is there an hours of operation there also?
Mr. Chair, for those, it's the actual hours of service delivered. So we schedule, on a ride-by-ride basis, and so it's the actual hours used to deliver the rides that were provided is the hours.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Scott.
I think this will be my last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure when the appropriate time to ask this question is, so I'll just do it now since we're paused. But when Central Corridor opens up, will they still run the buses up and down University? Will those routes still be operational, or will those go away?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there will be changes to the bus service. The Route 50, which is a limited stop today, will no longer operate. The Route 16, which is a local, stops more frequently, every couple blocks, shall we say. Its frequency will be reduced, so it will not come quite as often. And then the Route 94 express between the downtowns will be focused in the peak hours, whereas today it runs all day. On the other hand, there will be new investment in bus service, primarily local bus service running more north-south, not exclusively, but that will provide connecting people via bus to the train. For example, on the Blue Line Hiawatha, it's 40-some percent, mm-hmm. a significant share of the riders on the Blue Line get to the Blue Line via a bus connection. And that's why those investments in the connecting bus routes are so important.
Thank you.
We are down to about 3.5 okay. minutes left, so Mr. Petrie, you're going to really get off scot-free. Representative?
I think this is quick, Mr. Chair.
Run back quickly, yes.
Great. In your unified budget, I see there's a number of items in the area of fare collection equipment. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if those are, is that something things you're trying? Or is it just a growing area of the budget? We're working on ways to improve fare collection? Or are these just standard?
Okay, committee members and chair and committee members, my name is Ed Petrie with Metro Transit. I'm representing Mr. Land this afternoon. Fare collection equipment. Our prime fare collection equipment right now is the Cubic Go-To system. Everybody's probably very familiar with the green Go-To card. We have both that, and we have also the magnetic cards that are used on the trim units on the buses. We're always looking at different changes within the fare collection system, upgrades to the fare collection system. In fact, now this coming, within the next year, we'll be doing a software upgrade to our Cubic system, which is the contactless smart card.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee members, once again, Ed Petrie, Metro Transit. I will go very quickly through the operating budgets.
I'll bet you
will. The full transportation operating budget, as you can see on this slide, is $543 million. On the right side, you'll see the uses. It's broken down between our base operations of $467 million, or 86%. There's two other items, which include the pass-through to the suburban transit providers. This is where we're actually passing through motor vehicle sales tax to the transit providers for their operations. And then $47 million for debt service, which Ms. Bogie talked about earlier. On the right-hand side, you'll see the sources of funding. There was a question earlier concerning what comprises the subsidy, what is paying for the subsidy. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll see fares. First of all, that comprises $105 million of our proposed budget in 2014. The balance of the items include motor vehicle sales tax, which is $219 million. State appropriations in at $74 million. We have federal funds of $31 million. This is mainly for two different items. First of all, it's for about $13 to $14 million of the final testing costs on the Central Corridor line prior to moving into revenue operations mid-year. And then it's also for some staff time working on other capital projects that are paid for by federal funds. We have the CTIP funding in at $24 million, which pays for 50% of the net cost on our transit ways. Property taxes of $46 million for the Transit Oriented Development Department. That's coming from community development over to Metro Transit. And then we have other funds of $44 million. There was a question concerning that, Mr. Chair, committee members earlier. That is comprised of about $11 million worth of advertising and interest income. You're probably very familiar seeing the trains and the buses with all the wraps and the advertising. We generate about $7 to $8 million a year with advertising between in our whole system. It also includes planned use of fund balance reserves and planned use of MVEST reserves. If you back out the pass-through and the debt service, this brings you down to the pure transportation operations budget for 2014. On the left-hand side, the upper left-hand side, you'll see by department, once again, Metro Transit, which is the largest portion. Metro Transit bus operations is about $299 million, or 64%. You'll see the balance of the family of operations, which would include Green Line. Once again, that includes about $13 to $14 million of finalizing testing, and then the balance would be moving into operations mid-year. We have the Hiawatha Blue Line, North Star, Metro Mobility, Transportation Planning, Transit Link, and then some fixed route service. The right-hand side of the category, as you could imagine, we're a very labor-intensive organization with the operators in at about 57% of our costs. Then we have the transit programs, which would include Metro Mobility and contracted services. Then the balance of costs, which would be some regional allocation from regional administration and interdivisional costs, fuel and utilities, material supplies, and consulting. Sources down below, like the previous slide, once again, MVEST is in at $190 million, the state at $74 million. Then we have the balance with the federal CTIB and fares.
Mr. Chair.
Question from Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question regarding the FTEs, which have grown substantially. Can you just give us a little bit of an idea where those, what categories, what departments, what kind of employees we're hiring?
Mr. Chair, committee members, as Ms. Bogie had stated earlier in the meeting today, most of the FTE growth has been on the rail lines. For example, we brought, during the last 10 years, we brought Hiawatha Light Rail on. Hiawatha Light Rail currently has approximately 190 FTEs, combination of operators, mechanics, and other support staff. We're currently right now in the process of hiring up for the Central Corridor line. As of the end of 2012, we were at about 45 FTEs. We anticipate by the time it moves into revenue operations, mid-year 2014 will be approximately between 175 and 180 FTEs. In the Central Corridor line, which once again would be predominantly operators and mechanics and some janitorial staff. We also have our Southwest Project Office, which currently as of the end of 2012, I believe had around 15 people in it. As Southwest will move forward into 2014, we're anticipating adding about another 20 to 25 staff into the Southwest office. So it's been predominantly mainly Hiawatha and Central Corridor operators, mechanics, support staff, maintenance folks.
Thank you.
As we mentioned earlier, there is about $28.7 or $29 million worth of pass-through money that's going to be passed through to the suburban transit providers, the MVEST funds. It is made up of two different portions. First of all, there's the base MVEST fund, or the base allocation, which is based upon the statutory amount. That will be allocated to all providers at about $22.4 million. On top of that, there will be some regionally allocated MVEST funds that will be allocated to both MVTA and Southwest. This is so they can maintain current operations, but also the purpose of that is so they can refill to maintain their current reserve levels at their established limits. Our CIP portion for our budget for the next, for the 14 through 19, it's a very transitway intensive CIP. It's about a $2 billion CIP. There was a question earlier concerning some of the costs that we did have in the CIP. Once again, it's about $1.3 billion. That includes about almost $100 million to finish the Green Line. We have about just over $1.2 billion in there for the Southwest Line. And there was also a question concerning the Botno Boulevard, Botno Corridor. We currently right now in the CIP have $1 million early planning money in the CIP for Botno Boulevard. We also have a table that's called Table 3A for unfunded projects. We have Botno Boulevard listed as an unfunded project at $1 billion. When the funding is identified and if that project moves farther along, we will then amend it and bring it into the CIP and the capital budget at that point in time.
Representative Brunbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Mr. Petrie?
Yes, Mr. Petrie.
Okay. Reading some information about federal funding and some of the standards have been relaxed, loosened. So I'm just curious how that's going to affect the forward programs that you're looking at. There's just not, you know, don't have to prove cost efficiency, don't have to prove cost effectiveness, don't have, streetcar doesn't have to meet environmental impact standards. So talk about streetcar, if you would, and talk about what you see for the future beyond beyond SRT or SWT, whatever. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll take that question. First
Ms.
of all, MAP 21, the federal transportation bill, did change the what we call the new starts and small starts criteria. There still remains what's called the cost effectiveness index. The way they apply it is different. But the federal FTA, when they evaluate projects, they very much look at minimum type requirements for a project, such as ridership, cost effectiveness. And then there's the other side of local funding sources is very important, land use decisions, things like that. So their rating categories remain what existed before. How they apply them has changed a little bit, but that hasn't. That isn't completely, they haven't completely eliminated what they had before. On the streetcar side, streetcars often could be considered a small starts type of a project. It's a competitive process, and there are more projects across the country that would like to be funded at the federal level than there is definitely funding for. So I think that helps you understand that the feds do have a process by which they evaluate and compare the projects. Regarding streetcars, the council's in the midst of updating its transportation policy plan, and we will be looking at some policy questions relating to streetcars, because I think, as you know, both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul are moving forward streetcar plans, and so we're looking at that more intently now.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Thompson, at what level of the Met Council are you looking at you know, the fiscal prudence of some of these policies? I mean, do you weigh in? I mean, streetcars, Minneapolis and St. Paul may want them, but do they make any sense? And, you know, is it federal funding still 50%? What's the makeup of the funding sources there?
Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a very good question, and that's exactly the type of policy questions that have to be looked at. What should be the funding sources for streetcar? We anticipate at the federal level, we know that there's not going to be more federal money, most likely. The federal share, we just have to be, we're uncertain. The current federal transportation bill expires in 2014, so we don't know what the future will hold. But I would say the questions that you're asking are questions that have to be answered through the by the council through their policy plan. And they're very good questions.
We can help. Still have more?
Okay, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll finish here quickly. $2 billion CIP, once again, the left-hand side, if you look at it, but like I said, very transitway dependent, $1.3 billion. We have fleet in at $466 million, and then some costs for facilities and transit and technology and equipment. A category, once again, preservation's in at 30%, transitways are in at 66%. If you remove the transitway slice and just look at preservation and expansion, as with the other divisions within the council, preservation moves up from 30% to 87% of our overall CIP. So once again, we're very focused on preservation of our current assets, buses, garages, et cetera. Sources of funding, once again, is $1.1 billion coming from federal sources, once again, predominantly from the transitways. We have CTIP funding at $347 million, regional transit capital at $248, some state funding at $117 million, and other funding of $145 million, which is mainly from counties and railroad authorities for the various transitways. The final slide that I have today is on the transit debt service. Once again, our transit debt service for transit is relatively stable. It runs at about $210 to $220 million per year. Routine debt service is about $44 million a year. As Ms. Bogie had stated earlier today, you see a slight spike in 2015. That is due to some bond refunding of about $30 million that we're planning on. And once again, that bond refunding is already set up in an escrow account. With that, Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation.
Well, thank you very much. Any wrap-up questions? I would encourage that if you do have some more questions that you take them offline if you can. We have one more agenda item that we'd like to cover here. We've run over just a bit, but I would like to have Representative Hornstein make some comments on our item number 4, the Met Council governance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be very brief here. This is an item that I had requested be on the agenda, and obviously we won't have the discussion today, but hopefully at our next meeting, Mr. Chair, we can drill a little deeper into this. You know, this is something that I think bipartisanly there's been concern about, you know, got some governance issues around the Met Council, the nature of it as an appointed body, and we had a legislative auditor's report that I know when Representative Beard was chair of the Transportation Finance Committee, we had some extensive discussion about, and I think there was some interest in looking at those recommendations and seeing if there is interest among legislators in looking at the governance of the Met Council. Should it be elected? Should there be other elected officials on it? Or is there some hybrid of those? I know the Met Council itself has put forward some issues around staggered terms. So there's a lot of options, a lot of directions we could go if this is something that the legislature was interested in. So I just wanted to put that out there, see if there was interest in by commission members that I think this would be an appropriate body to have some hearings on that. You know, we have various stakeholders that may want to weigh in on this. And if there's interest, you know, I certainly would be willing to work bipartisanly with a group of people to develop a proposal. If there's not, fine. I mean, then I think the status quo persists, and, you know, that's the will of the legislature and the stakeholders. It's not just us, but we have a lot of other people that have an interest in the Met Council. You know, but it's really up to the citizenry. It's up to us, I think, if we want to move forward on this. There's a lot of talk, I think, every time we have an issue related to the Met Council, someone says on the House floor in committee, you know, we have this unelected, unaccountable body, and, you know, people nod in agreement, but yet nothing is done to really address that issue. So it's something that's on my mind, and I'm certainly willing to work with anyone that's interested in it, of course, with the Met Council itself. But I think it's an appropriate we as a commission on metropolitan governance, that's in the name of the commission, I think we're an appropriate body to at least talk about that issue. So that's really it, Mr. Chairman, and I guess we'll just punt this into the next meeting. But certainly I wanted to put that out, and I'm interested in working, again, bipartisanly with people that have an interest in this issue.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Senator Dibble.
I'm interested, Mr. Chair.
Interested. Okay, good. Any other comments? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move forward with that. We worked 2 years ago on a bipartisan effort. We had some bills that got to the governor's desk, and he vetoed them. So, my concern is that we'll go through the motions, and we're going to have the same outcome. The bills that we had were ones for staggered terms. I believe Representative Scalzi, I think you carried that one. And we've talked about some other. We had a whole batch of bills that we sent over, and even something as simple as staggered terms was vetoed. So, we're not in charge right now. So, if you've gotten the go-ahead from the governor that he's willing to do something, I think that's worth pursuing. And the other comment I would have is I'd like an update on Thrive 2014 at some point and before it becomes final. I think that this body would be the one that would hear that, so I would ask the chair if that would be an item that we could have a meeting on. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
I would echo Representative Hornstein's comments, and I've worked with Representative Hornstein in the past in the House, and we've generally done a lot of work, had a lot of debate, and we've had vetoes bipartisan, depends on who's the governor. So it's just one of those things I think that we have to continue to chip away at, and maybe one day we'll find success.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, members, I have served on the Eagan Park Commission, the Eagan City Council, the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, the Suburban Transit Authority, so I have a lot of interest and experience, and I believe that changes needed to be made, so I definitely want to work on this.
And Representative Freiberg.
Since we're all going on the record, I'm interested in working on it as well, having served on a city council, having experienced Met Council mandates kind of personally mm-hmm. in that capacity as well. So be interested to see what people think should happen.
Thank you. I might as well agree.
Okay. All right, Representative Ronbeck.
Well, and I think as chair, I'm going to support this too.
Thank you, members, for that.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for your input. Thank you very much for your reports. This commission is going to meet again soon at the call of the chair, and I would appreciate if anyone does have, let's say, perspectives on how we should run that particular discussion or any other discussion that falls within our purview. You can take a look at our assignment is on statute 3.8841. It describes who we are, how we do it, and what we're supposed to be doing. And if you have anything that you would like us to take a look at, you please contact me or any one of the members, and we'll see that we get it onto our agenda. And our next meeting is going to be at the call of the chair. We won't schedule it today, but I appreciate you all for coming, and thank you very much. With that, the meeting is adjourned.